Case number 20-3329, 3331, and 3332. Joseph Forrester Trucking, H&P Coal Company, Inc., and Lockworth, Inc. versus OWCP et al. Oral argument is not to exceed 20 minutes for the petitioners and 20 minutes to be shared by the respondents. Mr. Solomons, you may proceed for the petitioners.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court.
Good morning. Let me welcome you to the Sixth Circuit. I somehow didn't do that before we called the case.
Okay. Well, thank you. This case involves an issue that has been litigated to a significant degree in a number of different courts recently. The question is where and to what extent issue exhaustion is required.
Mr. Solomons, I'm having a little bit of a hard time hearing you. I'm sorry to interrupt you right out of the gate. Is there any way to turn up your volume, or maybe it's me and I can do it?
I'll try it.
Okay.
I'm just pulling the speaker a little bit closer. Okay, can you hear me, sir?
Yes, that's better.
Okay. This court, in its decisions in Ramsey and Bryan, building on the Supreme Court's decision in Sims, has settled on a template of principles for evaluating whether a structural constitutional challenge must be raised before the agency ALJ before going to court, and at what stage of the proceedings the issue needs to be presented to the agency, if at all. While I think that, you know, there is a background which I think needs to be mentioned. While the Federal Circuit's decision in Arthrex and perhaps the Supreme Court's decisions in Freitag, Glidden, and arguably Lucia as well, are to the contrary, this court has rejected the principle that structural constitutional issues need to be presented to the agency.
Well, I mean, let's just take a step back for a second on this. I would typically have a good deal of sympathy for a party that is reluctant to file something akin to a motion to recuse. And I would have even more sympathy if when that party doesn't even have a right to a jury trial, which is true here. That said, this case, at least as described, I think rather clearly in the department's brief, is one where your client had apparently something like an automatic entitlement to a new ALJ while the case was before the ALJ, if only your client had asked. So with respect to that premise itself, do you agree you could have gotten a new ALJ at the time had you asked, because other parties were getting that? Well, do you agree with that, sir, or not?
Well, not exactly, no. This case was before an administrative law judge. All three cases were before administrative law judges in 2015, 2016, and the trials in all of the cases took place in the fall.
Can I push back a little bit on that? Because I think in Mr. Smith's brief, he lays out, I can't remember what page, where your co-counsel, I think it was your co-counsel for Willis Hogg Coal Company, moved before ALJ Sylvan, I think after the fact, for reconsideration based on that. And he recused even after rendering a decision. And then Mr. Smith laid out where in 20 other or so cases, ALJ Sylvan did the same. So how can you say no?
Well, let me say that, first of all of these judges were ratified in December of 2017.
Nobody's talking about that. I mean, the question is whether you agree you had an entitlement at the time, or were your clients confused about that? And if so, why, given that other parties similarly situated were getting it? It's really a factual question, basically, about the record and what was happening.
Okay. Well, what I can say about that, I can't speak for other attorneys, but after ratification in December of 2017, which was well before, which was around the time that these cases, well, before the time that all of these cases were decided, no ALJ is granting an opportunity.
Okay, but after Lucia, you know, I mean, the import of ratification was made pretty clear. And we're talking about a post-Lucia timeframe, 4 months. Why didn't you guys file then? It seemed obvious you could have gotten then automatically what you're asking us to do now after you lost.
I'm not sure that that's true. I think that I know that we had in other cases, and perhaps Mr. Smith cited some of the other cases, that there were situations where pre-ratification, we asked for a new administrative law judge under the principles announced in Lucia, and we got them. However, after ratification, nobody got them. And I guess
I thought the question Judge Kethledge was asking was that Lucia was decided while your case was still pending before the ALJ issued decisions in any of these cases, and in none of those cases you had months, 3 or 4 months, in none of those cases did you assert Lucia objection post Lucia while the case was still before the ALJ. And the regulations seem pretty generous in terms of if you raise an issue at any time while a case is pending before the ALJ, that preserves it. So the rule is sort of generous to you in that you could have raised it sort of late in the day, but you didn't do that. You raised it once the case left the ALJ and went to the board.
Well, I really, it's hard for me to speak for the trial counsel, but I think that, you know, there was a general feeling that these issues weren't appropriately raised before ALJs anyway.
Mr. Solomon, you raised it. I'm looking at your brief, your associate's brief, that is at 117 of the joint appendix, post Lucia, moving for reconsideration based on Lucia, and Sylvan recuses in that case. This is your firm.
Okay, that's not these cases. And it's...
I understand, but the question was, could you have? The very first question Judge Kethledge asked was, could you have?
I suppose that you could, when this issue first gained some recognition, which would have been during the days of Bandemir, during the days when these issues were being raised before the SEC, which would take us back to maybe 2016 or 2015 sometime, I suppose you could have raised it.
But how about post 2018?
I know, but the issues were not decided.
How about post Lucia, or however you say it, post Lucia? How about then? I mean, it was right there in front of you.
I think you could have raised it, yes. And you may have from some ALJs, I guess, if Sylvain granted it in that particular case, then we were able to get the relief that we wanted. I don't know what the other administrative law judges would have done, or in fact, in each one of these cases.
By not seeking it, don't you forfeit? I mean, it seems ridiculous that they are granting it. Your friend on the other side lays out how many times they've granted it. And now you're coming to us and saying it would have been futile.
Well, I think it would have been futile. They wouldn't have done anything for us. I mean, I think that's fairly clear.
Now, no, it's not. Not at all. We need to work on the same sort of facts and reality here. Where is Mr. Bush wrong in his brief when he lays out a string cite about the cases in which post Lucia parties were getting a new LJ when they asked? What's wrong about that? And I think we need a straight answer about what's wrong, because if we don't get a persuasive answer, I think, at least speaking for myself, your position is very precarious in this case.
Well, I think that I don't have those cases right in front of me, but that post Lucia, I mean, here we had a decision which came out before Lucia.
Which decision came out before Lucia? Because I have them in October of 2018 in all three cases.
Yeah, that was my
trial. All right, the trials were in 2017. They were in 2018. And Lucia was decided in June of 2018.
And the decision
post-trial, but pre-decision. And again, the regulations are pretty generous. I think they allow you to raise an issue basically at any point while the case is still before the ALJ.
I think they do allow you to do that. And they allow the administrative law judge to raise the issue as well, which he did in this case.
Yeah, but that to me is evidence of your failing in a sense. I mean, even the ALJ just acknowledged the issue, not that a party raised it, but the ALJ was on the ball to note that this was an issue and they made mention of it. But just because the ALJ, I mean, to me, that's just evidence that if it was obvious to the ALJ, it would have been obvious to you and your clients too to raise.
Well, I think, you know, the fact that the ALJ raised it on the record and decided it on the record, it seemed to me that it became appropriate at that time and to raise it as an issue before the Benefits Review Board under their rules, which was done.
I would say he identified the issue. I don't know if he raised it and decided. I think he just identified.
Well, he decided that he was ratified, and he reaffirmed all of the decisions that he had made prior to his ratification.
Wouldn't he have benefited from hearing your view on the issue? I mean, isn't that why we have these preservation requirements in our court too, which requires counsel to raise the aspect that they're complaining of, which then allows for an informed decision by the lower tribunal, so the higher tribunal has something to review?
Well, I think that it would have been nice if they had done that, but I don't think that it's required for them for someone to have done that, since it was raised anyway by the administrative law judge.
Well, what about the claimant here? I mean, I know he is deceased, but how is it fair to the claimant if you litigate this to conclusion in front of the ALJ and he gets a favorable result, and now you're asking us to take that away based on an argument you could have made at the time? Doesn't that just violate basic notions of fairness?
Well, I sympathize with all of the claimants who had decisions taken away from them. There have been quite a few. But I think that the question of whether, I guess, what Justice Scalia called sandbagging or Judge Seiler called sandbagging really isn't necessarily relevant to the resolution of what rights we had and under what circumstances we had a right to raise an issue before the benefits.
Well, you didn't assert those rights. Had you prevailed, would you have argued in front of the review board that the ALJ decision should be vacated on appointments clause grounds?
Oh, I really can't say. I wasn't, if we had prevailed, I assume they probably wouldn't, but the claimant could have.
Well, we would say no because it was too late to raise the issue. There's just a real forum. I mean, I think Justice Scalia and Judge Seiler were right about the forum shopping concerns by sandbagging or just not raising the issue until you find out whether you've won or lost.
Well, I don't think that's what they did. I don't think that motive really plays that much of a role here. And, you know, it may well be and probably was the case that counsel may not have been aware of this. I mean, it wasn't a really long time.
Really? That'd be like almost malpractice not to know about the Supreme Court decision.
Well, I
mean, your firm was clearly aware of it.
Right. But we didn't represent these clients before the administrative law judge, or for that matter, before the benefits.
We make criminal defendants be aware of things. You're telling me you can't make lawyers be aware of Supreme Court cases that basically Lucia was one of the biggest cases of the term?
Well, I really cannot explain the reason why that, the issue wasn't raised earlier. And it may well have been, again, you can't ascribe motive to these folks or evil motive. It may well have been they just didn't know about it. And these are workers' compensation lawyers. They don't spend a lot of time on SCOTUS blog looking to see what's coming down the pipeline. It was not something. And also, there was an expectation that the administrative law judges wouldn't do anything about it anyway. Now, if Judge Sylvain did, in some cases, address the objections in those circumstances, then that's fine. I don't know about whether the other judges would have. Most of the judges, and they all today will not address it, will cite their ratification and just leave it at that and say, we're not going to talk about it. We're not going to address it because we've been ratified. Now that raises another issue, but that it is futile to raise it before the administrative law judges. And it would have been reasonable if you knew about ratification. By the way, nobody told anybody about ratification. There was no bulletin that went out to the people who are involved in these cases and said that we're going to ratify everything, all of these administrative law judges. And I think that the period of time that elapsed between the decision and the
4 months.
Lucia, yeah. I mean, that's in the black lung world, that's not a lot of time. And the appeal was filed in a timely way.
Okay. Why don't we hear what the department has to say? So let's hear from Mr. Bush.
We can't hear you. I can't hear.
How about now, Your Honor?
We can hear you now.
Okay. My name is William Bush. May it please the court. I'm William Bush for the director.
Mr. Bush, you're cutting in and out for some reason.
Oh.
I still can't.
Yeah. I don't know if you have a problem with your speaker.
Mr. Bush, you seem to be coming through this morning fine. Did you change anything?
No. I just got a notice that my internet connection is unstable, however.
Okay, that's not your fault.
I disconnected from our government VPN in the hopes that would bring things up.
You're better now.
Okay, well, let's go with it and keep
our fingers crossed. My apologies, Your Honor.
It's all right.
Once more, may it please the court. My name is William Bush for the Director, Office of Workers' Compensation Programs. Under the governing regulations and case law that we laid out in our brief, the parties are responsible for raising issues in black lung cases, and they must do so before the ALJ if they want to preserve review of those issues before the Benefits Review Board and later the courts. The parties, the employers in these three cases had ample opportunity and time, as I think the court made clear in the opening argument, to raise these challenges while the case was pending before the ALJ. And instead of doing that, they waited until they lost the case. And that is just quintessential sandbagging. It violates the spirit of adversarial litigation. And for that reason, we're asking the court to rule that these claims were forfeited and that there was no excuse for their forfeiture.
Mr. Bush, I think, you point out in your brief that sometimes there are regulatory exhaustion requirements, and then in some instances, courts have recognized implied exhaustion requirements. As to the regulations you cite, I'm trying to figure out, which one might be your strongest, provide your strongest argument. I'm not sure if any is really on point. Perhaps I want to ask you about section 1880C, and this is the pre-hearing statement, as I understand it, that a party presents to the ALJ after some initial determination by the district director. And you suggest that regulation is the one that required these petitioners to present the issue to the ALJ. In that statement, I suppose. But I guess when I also look at your citation of these cases where mid-proceeding the ALJ recuses, so to speak, based on Lucia, my guess is that those parties not all of those parties probably raised this issue in that same Section 1880C pre-hearing statement, which makes me infer that they didn't need to put it there in order to preserve, which makes me infer further that that's not a regulation that required them to present this earlier. I know that's a lot of change, but you know this stuff. So I guess, what am I missing? And, you know, is there a better argument that you have on the regulatory side?
Well, thank you for that question, Your Honor. And I wish we'd made it a little clearer in our brief in retrospect.
No, your brief was very good.
I think we're citing about 29 CFR Title 18 there, or Chapter 18 there, is a set of general rules that apply to DOL ALJ proceedings. And we note that those rules can be supplanted, and the petitioner notes this too, that those rules can be supplanted by program-specific rules. Now, we mentioned 1880 for the general proposition that in this regulatory scheme, parties have a sort of a general notice that if you want the ALJ to decide an issue, you have to bring it to the ALJ's attention. And in those general rules, a pre-hearing statement 20 days before the hearing is the general rule. And as the court pointed out in argument earlier today, 20 CFR 725.463 is the rule that supplants that rule. It's a more specific program rule. And it doesn't change necessarily everything about that rule, but it does change both the scope of the issues that can be raised to the ALJ, and provides a standard for adding issues to that list of things that were decided by the district director or flagged for the district director. And it also expands the time that you can raise issues. And whereas the general rule say 20, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah, can I ask a different one, which is, if you don't mind, if we can stay on the regs. So your colleague, counsel for Davis, on page 13, cited 20 CFR 802.301A, which I don't think you cited. And so I'm curious about that, because that says that the Benefits Review Board is not empowered to engage in a de novo proceeding or an unrestricted review of the case. And then it goes on to say that, and this is at page 13 of their brief, instead, the board is authorized to review the findings of fact and conclusions of law on which the decision or order appealed from was based. I mean, being a former district judge, that sounds like our review of district courts, which, of course, Justice Thomas goes through in Sims. So why isn't that the best reg? Or am I missing something?
I think it is a good reg, Your Honor. And that is I don't think it's quite a word for word restatement, but it is perfectly consistent with the statutory grant of authority to the Benefits Review Board setting, in section 21 of the Longshore Act, establishing the board as an appellate administrative body that gives the board only a kind of second level review, I guess, first level review, second level in general, look at things that were in the ALJ's decision. We mentioned that statutory grant of authority or limitation on authority, really, in the prudential section of our brief. Our reading of Brian was that to bring our best argument forward for a regulatory exhaustion requirement, it should be something specific to the ALJ hearing level. And the section 802 regs are procedure before the Benefits Review Board. And we agree that they indirectly limit what or make place requirements on what can be done before the.
It just seemed very similar to the language Justice Thomas was quoting when he was talking about Court of Appeals versus district courts and what authority Court of Appeals had. And so I just extrapolated from that. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
I think I would agree with your reasoning. And that's why we bring it up in the prudential section of our brief. We just felt that based on the way the Brian decision was structured, that we would be making our best argument if we were, it's almost as if, and not to peek behind the scenes here, but in an earlier draft of our brief, I had suggested that some of these Benefits Review Board regulations and statutory provisions create you know, they imply the existence of a of an exhaustion requirement before the ALJ. But once you're talking about implied exhaustion requirements, the worry is that you're automatically putting yourself in the Category 3 bucket. But I agree with you that if you read the Benefits Review Board statutory limitations on its review authority and the regulations that implement those, you're really stuck as an indirect matter. Unfortunately, it is indirect, and that's why we wanted to show the court an ALJ regulation that was specific to proceedings before that board. And so that's why we went with the, and admittedly, it's kind of a constellation of regulations suggesting.
Can I take you away from that constellation to a different point? Your friend on the other side said something along the lines of the Appointments Clause challenge is a structural challenge, and structural challenges can't be waived or shouldn't be allowed to be waived in this setting, and said that our circuit either had not decided the issue or affirmatively had decided the issue, contrary to some other precedent, which says that this argument gets no special treatment. What's your take on that issue and our precedent?
Well, the way we read Jones Brothers and Wilkerson and Bryan, and Ramsey for that matter, the Appointments Clause challenge is not entitled to special treatment. And particularly if there's a regulatory exhaustion requirement, there's no special treatment for it. This court has said repeatedly, four times now, that it's a non-jurisdictional argument that's subject to the ordinary rules of forfeiture and waiver. And whereas here we have a setting that, and just to stay on that point for a moment, courts that have granted parties the right to do that, where they've admitted that arguably was waived below. That's to say, not the SEC, where the SEC has de novo review and initial review, not the Patent and Trademark Office. But in cases like Freytag, the Supreme Court was saying that that's a rare remedy or rare waiver of that requirement, and that it should be only used in kind of extreme circumstances. And we don't think that's the case here. And that's only highlighted where, as here, every ALJ in the Department of Labor was properly appointed as of December 21st, 2017. And so after that point, there's no, you know, you have a properly appointed officer who can grant some kind of relief. And certainly, as the court pointed out, after the And we have, just to hit this very briefly, we have plenty of evidence of ALJs in early 2018 looking back at their prior decisions and saying, now that I'm a properly appointed officer, I'm going to reconsider and remake those findings as a properly appointed officer. That's an Appointments Clause remedy. Turns out in Lucia, it wasn't the correct remedy, but nobody knew that the Lucia
right.
remedy.
So your friend on the other side would say that you're right, the ALJs did that. And in fact, in all the decisions and orders before us, the ALJs sort of flagged this issue. They acknowledged that they had been reappointed, and that was, whether they cited Lucia or not, it was obviously the import of Lucia that was driving that. Why isn't that enough to preserve the issue? I mean, the judges themselves identified the issue, flagged it, and maybe thought that a higher court would decide whether that was appropriate or not.
Well, the ALJ in Mabe noted specifically that it had not been challenged by a party.
Yeah, the other two didn't say that, though.
The other two didn't say that. We don't think that raises the issue. As I think, Judge Radler, you pointed out in argument earlier this morning, we don't think that actually raises the issue. And, you know, it's the ALJ acknowledging that this Lucia case came out. It's not responsive to a motion by a party. And if we just take a look at Section 725.463 in Title 20 again, that regulation tells us that if an ALJ raises a new issue sua sponte, he has to give notice to the parties that he's raising it. And the ALJs didn't do that in this case. So in just putting it in a footnote in their decision and order, even if the court were to consider that raising the issue, it would be an error by the ALJ. And it would be a harmless error because Appointments Clause challenges are subject to waiver and forfeiture, and these parties waived it. So that's our response there. And as the court noted, there are also cases where ALJs flag the issue as having been previously raised and gave parties the opportunity to sort of take back their challenge to it and consent to maybe they thought the hearing went really well before that ALJ and they want to stick with it. Just to turn briefly to prudential exhaustion, if I may, since we haven't talked about it yet. As we set forth in our brief, that unlike Social Security claims and the other claims that have been maybe dealt with in some of these prior cases, black lung cases are inherently adversarial. And we think that the regulations place plenty of formal limits on what parties can do. You know, they limit the kinds of evidence and the amount of evidence and when that evidence has to be submitted. This isn't a case where the department acts as an inquisitorial figure. You know, the Black Lung Benefits Act makes coal companies responsible for paying the benefits. And so they appear as defendants in these cases and rigorously oppose benefits, and claimants appear almost always, I think, represented by counsel and vigorously make their cases for it. And the Benefits Review Board has been enforcing its own prudential exhaustion requirement for 40 years. So, you know, to the point earlier, to talk about parties in these cases and particularly employers in these cases being represented by attorneys, the Benefits Review Board expects them to know about its own prior precedent. And that's been unchanged for four decades.
This is like a federal tort claim rather than a benefits determination, it seems like.
It's an unusual system, Your Honor. It's a benefits claim in the sense that the department says what you have to prove to get benefits, but you're right. In the representational system, it's a lot like a tort claim. Mm-hmm. There are no further questions. The government will rest on its brief and ask the court to deny the petitions for review in these cases.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Bush. We'll hear from Mr. Smith.
Please the court. My name is Evan Smith. I'm here to represent the claimants, Arthur Davis, Cecil May Mabe, and Loyal Tackett. And one thing I'll add is that it appears that I learned this morning that it looks like Mr. Tackett passed away in 2019. So again, of the three claimants that were initially involved, two of them have died during, you know, the process since the ALJ's decisions in this case. And that really highlights the fairness concern that Judge Kearsledge, I thought that you properly brought up. You know, these cases have already drug out for a long time. Mr. Mabe's case, for example, has been pending for 9 years. And, you know, a do-over in this situation is not harmless to these people. I mean, these are monthly benefits, and these people have not received the retroactive benefits that they deserve. Even if the trust fund is providing some interim benefits, dragging this out has a real effect financially, and not to mention just as, again, as a matter of basic fairness. You can imagine that if you're the family member of this, you think you've got an award, and suddenly this is getting pulled back from you due to nothing that came up when it was before the judge. So, again, I think that the forfeiture issue has been well covered. You know, and by the way, Judge Leparle just added that, yes, this certainly could have been brought up. I mean, there was a general order from the Cincinnati office of the Office of Administrative Law Judges. If we were all there at the Potter Stewart Courthouse today, it would be a few blocks away. All three of the ALJs here were part of that office, and they all had a general order that said, if you brought a Lucia challenge, then you were entitled to a new hearing before a different ALJ. So again, as a factual matter, the parties here certainly could have gotten a new decision from a different ALJ, just like Willis Hogg.
Do you know when that order came out? I'm sorry for not knowing that.
One second. And I'm sorry, the order itself doesn't have a date on it, but it came out on October 19th, 2018. And so we filed that in the supplemental appendix in Mr. Mabe's case, and that's on page 64 of that, and brought it up on page 30 of my response brief there.
Okay.
So again, just to answer the factual question, I believe that the record is clear on that. Now, the one thing that I want to bring up as an alternative basis to affirm, if for somehow, you know, the court wanted to use its discretion to find this was somehow the rare case where you wanted to reach the merits, you know, the petitioners here have not met their burden on the merits to show that these judges were actually hired improperly. You know, they didn't build a record about how these judges were hired. And then even more so, when you look at, you know, I think that Mr. Mabe's case is the most clear. There wasn't actually a hearing in that case. It was an on-the-decision record, and the judge did not admit evidence until after his appointment was ratified. And this came up in Lucia. Now, the Supreme Court didn't actually issue a holding about ratification, but in the government's brief in Lucia, they explained why ratification was an appropriate remedy to cure appointments clause problems prospectively. Again, retrospectively, there's an issue, but that's not what we have in these cases. And then also that came up in Ramsey, where this court held that a ratification cures this for decisions going forward. So we have that in all these cases. All these judges' appointments were ratified before they issued the decisions, which are the decisions and orders that award benefits. Those, that's the first time that the delegated sovereign authority of the United States really comes to force. That's the first time that these employers are expected to truly pay benefits in these cases. So again, that all happened before in these cases. So I'll kind of pause if the court has any questions. I'm happy to talk about the practical aspects of forfeiture or, again, the merits of these issues if the court has any interest in that.
Any questions, anybody? Okay. We don't have any further questions for you, Mr. Smith, so we appreciate your argument, and we will hear rebuttal from Mr. Solomons.
Mr. Solomons, you're muted.
I'm sorry. The Department of Labor's characterization of Black Lung proceedings is nothing like federal tort claims. It's much more like Social Security.
I said that.
They often don't have hearings. Claimants are often not represented. The hearings, when they have them, take 30, 45 minutes. And it's all pretty much truncated by a bunch of rules that the Labor Department has.
Can I go back to the Judge Kethledge's fundamental fairness point, which it seems to me all of the administrative law judges, and I apologize for missing this earlier, and I'm looking at it now, pages 64 and 65, said they would reassign the case even after the decision was rendered. Your firm got one of them to do it after a decision was rendered. Now we're years later, two and a half years later, and they still haven't gotten their benefits going backwards, and two of them passed away. I mean, why not? Why wouldn't we hold you to the forfeiture?
Well, I would suggest that all of those that perspective of the issue is certainly a valid one, and one that should be considered. But I think that as far as the legal issues are concerned, they should override that. Perspective.
Do you disagree with Mr. Bush that we have said that we wouldn't treat this differently? He pointed to four cases, including Brian and Jones brothers, and he said Ramsey, the recent Social Security case, even reiterated that.
Well, I think in Ramsey, there's there is an indication in that case that you would treat it differently.
What page is that on? Because I'd like to...
In page 546, we talk about the significance of the appointments clause issue. And I don't know the degree to which, I mean, obviously some courts would treat it as being dispositive, but other courts, and this court has not treated it that way. It's still up there. It's before the Supreme Court right now. They denied cert in one case where the Federal Circuit held that you didn't have to raise it before the agency at all. And they've granted cert in two Social Security cases, which are at odds with the Social Security decision that you issued in Ramsey.
I mean, do those cases turn on the different regulatory schemes at issue between the SEC, Social Security, Black Lung?
Well, Social Security has no regulation. We contend that the Department of Labor has no regulation that really specifically addresses this, and to the extent
if we thought they did have a regulatory scheme, again, do these cases turn at all on the different regulatory schemes in place? I mean, the SEC had a different scheme as well. That was
I think they could. And I think that what you held in Brian was that it did turn on the regulatory scheme there. But in this particular instance, under the 7-8, I mean, you can pick pieces out of regulations and try to cobble together an issue. Basically, even under 29 CFR 18.10, This is the Department of Labor's regulation there doesn't apply. That procedure doesn't apply in black lung claims. They use a different procedure in black lung claims. And I think the department really has very much mischaracterized it by kind of melding these procedures together. They're not melded together. They operate very independently and differently. Yeah,
there, I mean, there's implied, you know, the potential for implied exhaustion requirements too.
Yeah,
particularly yes. when the fairness point is just so obvious as it is here.
I think that, you know, implied exhaustion is a principle that can be applied here, but the point that we're trying, and if you want to do that, and if the principle is that in black lung claims present such sympathetic circumstances, you're never going to want to let employers kind of get away with it, then there's probably nothing to talk about. But I think that there is something to talk about because the law doesn't go that way.
Okay. I think we understand your argument. Thank you.
Hey, may I say one more thing? One more thing. We think, I beg the court's
go ahead.
On this. We think ratification is totally illegal. It's a rule under 5 U.S.C. 5514. There's any question about it. The Labor Department told nobody about it at the beginning. There was a lot of confusion going on. And, you know, you can hold us responsible for not having worked our way through the confusion because maybe our firm did and some other firm didn't. But the fact of the matter is that this ratification rule has not been approved by any court of appeals. It certainly seems inconsistent with what the Supreme Court has said. And I think that because it is a rule, because rules must be published for notice and comment, and they cannot be retroactive.
All right. Now, I think we understand your point there. I mean, I would say, you know, Mr. Smith makes a good point about the human costs of perpetuating this proceeding, and we will carefully consider the merits, but I would suggest that parties in your position ought to carefully consider whether they really have even a colorable argument to present and thereby deny folks like these claimants benefits before they actually die. We will carefully consider your arguments and the case will be submitted. May call the next case.